Chapter 40. The One-Eyed Guru. During the 15 months that Satchapriya and I spent at Muvattuputta, three lawyers had been our closest friends. In Bangalore, where we stayed for a much shorter period, it was two railway engineers. Like Kumaran Nair and Kesava Pillai, they had known each other since they were boys, had worked together all their adult lives, and though equally religious-minded and the closest of friends, were of completely different temperaments. Narayan was quiet and reserved, not to say withdrawn, and apparently found it difficult to communicate with people. Though he'd been married for a number of years and had four or five children, he even found it difficult to communicate with his wife. Indeed, he never actually spoke to her. Whenever he wanted to say anything to her, he told his mother, who passed on the message. His mother, of course, lived with them, and it was she who managed the household. Rajgopal, on the contrary, was a lively, cheerful extrovert who experienced no difficulty whatever in getting on with people. He was on the best of terms with his wife and bevy of teenage daughters, who indeed treated him more like a favourite elder brother than as a husband or father. Our first few days in Bangalore was spent with Narayan in a spacious colonial-type bungalow that evidently dated from the highest and palmiest days of the Raj. We had met our new friend at Tiruvannamalai, where, having inspected a section of railway track, he was taking the opportunity of paying his respects to the Maharshi, and at his invitation we had accompanied him back to Bangalore. Our original plan had been to visit Pondicherry on the east coast and see Sri Aurobindo, but on learning that he gave darshan only four times a year, we had abandoned the idea. As we were still undecided what to do next when we met Narayan, his invitation seemed providential, especially as Bangalore, 200 miles distance from Tiruvannamalai, lay directly on the road back to North India. We therefore accepted the invitation with alacrity, and in a matter of hours were sitting in the Guj Railway Engineer's special bogie and heading north to Bangalore, the middle country, and perhaps ordination. Despite the presence of his family and the servants, Narayan's bungalow was very quiet. Apart from Rajgopal, whom we met soon after our arrival, there were no visitors, and Satchapriya and I were able to continue our meditations almost as usual. At night, our host played us records of Subha Lakshmi, the nightingale of the south, of which he had an extensive collection. Neither Satchapriya nor I had ever heard this celebrated songstress before, and were more than a little doubtful as to the propriety of our listening to anything so worldly as popular film music. However, Narayan was a passionate admirer of the singer's talent, and not wishing to spoil his enjoyment by raising objections, we said nothing. Subha Lakshmi had indeed a glorious voice, and whatever reservations we might have had about film music, it was impossible to deny that she sang devotional songs in a way that was extraordinarily moving. When Narayan had to go out on tour again, it was arranged that we should stay with Rajgopal. The change was so great as to be almost a shock. It was like being swept from some quiet but stagnant backwater, shaded with trees, out into the middle of the main stream, where gaily painted river craft raced up and down in the bright sunshine, oars dashed and sails billowed, and where people hailed one another joyfully from carved and gilded prows. Though smaller and less spacious than Narayan's, Rajgopal's bungalow behind the railway station was the scene of constant activity. In addition to Rajgopal himself and his wife and daughters, all of whom were gay and lively enough, there was a constant stream of visitors, all cheerful and communicative, all interested in religion, and all expected to stay for a meal. The place was busiest in the evening. In the lounge where Satchapriya and I slept, at least 15 or 20 people would gradually assemble, the men either in Western dress or the traditional white, the women without exception in colourful silk saris with borders of heavy gold or silver brocade. After general religious discussion, much music, and many devotional songs, Rajgopal would perform the arati, or ceremonial waving of lights, in front of the framed lithographs at the far end of the room, after which sweetmeats would be distributed. Sometimes he scandalized the more orthodox by performing arati not in a sarong, as traditionally prescribed, but in his customary trousers and shirt. Many of the devotional songs were in praise of the god Shiva. One of them was in praise of the Shiva Lingam. Satchipri and I could at first hardly believe our ears when we heard the rich soprano voice of Rajgopal's eldest daughter hymning the size, splendour and omnipotence of the divine phallus. But from her rapt expression, it was plain that she was quite unconscious of the actual meaning of the words. So far as she was concerned, and so far as her audience was concerned, she was simply singing the praises of Shiva. We had not been many days under Rajgopal's hospitable roof before discovering that the whole family, and many of their friends, were deep in spiritualism. Sessions with the Ouija board were held almost every day. Their spirit guide, Rajgopal told us, was Swami Vivekananda, with whom they were in constant communication, and whom they consulted on every aspect of their lives. True to his earthly reputation, the Swami was irascible in the extreme, and not only abused and scolded them incessantly, but frequently lost his temper. He was also in the habit of ordering the whole family to take a purificatory bath, sometimes making them do this as many as 7 or 8 times a day. Rajgopal's only son, a bright and impudent schoolboy of 16, happened to be a natural medium, and sometimes they relied on him, rather than the Ouija board, as their means of communication with the unseen. As soon as Satchipriya heard about the Ouija board, he was on fire with impatience to try it. "We would invoke the spirit of the Buddha," he exclaimed excitedly, "and consult him about our future." This sacrilegious proposal I flatly refused to countenance. Indeed, much as my curiosity had been aroused, I did not want to have anything to do with spiritualism. It was not that I dogmatically disbelieved in it, but rather that the atmosphere surrounding it seemed unhealthy. In the end, at Satchipriya's urgent entreaty, I reluctantly agreed to an experimental session. 4 of us participated. Sitting round the table on which the Ouija board rested, we touched the traveller very lightly with the tips of our fingers. Rajgopal invoked the spirit of the legendary hero Rama, popularly regarded as the 7th incarnation of the god Vishnu, and put a question. Almost immediately, after a brief preliminary shudder, the traveller darted off on its ball bearings, and moving swiftly from one letter of the alphabet to another, spelled out the answer to his question. Rajgopal put another question, then another, and received further answers in the same way. Though they were all acceptable enough, none of the answers was really in any way remarkable. What was remarkable was the fact that the traveller seemed to possess a will of its own, that it was activated by a force far in excess of the very insignificant pressure that we were exerting on it through our fingertips. So powerful was this force, indeed, that far from it being any unconscious impulse on our part that set the traveller in motion, it seemed rather as though our fingers were being dragged hither and thither against our will. Satchipriya was deeply impressed. Trembling with suppressed excitement, he asked Rajgopal to invoke the spirit of Mahatma Gandhi, and when communication had been established, put the question that he had in readiness. "Now that the country has been left without a leader, who will take your place?" Like millions of other Indians, what my friend wanted to know was whether it was Jawaharlal Nehru, Rajendra Prasad, Vallabhai Patel, Abul Kalam Azad, or even some individual as yet entirely unknown, who was going to succeed to the national leadership. Again, moving swiftly from letter to letter of the alphabet, the traveller spelled out an answer that was completely unexpected by any of us. The whole people. It was the whole people that would take Mahatma Gandhi's place, the whole people that would succeed to the national leadership. So unexpected was this answer, indeed, and so remote from our own assumptions, that in the first shock of astonishment, it really did feel as though we were in contact with a discarnate intelligence, independent of our own minds. Satchapriya, wildly excited, was ready to devote his life to spiritualism. Sessions with the Ouija board would have to be held every day, he declared. With the help of Mahatma Gandhi, Swami Vivekananda, and other spirit guides, it would be possible to solve the social and economic problems of India, indeed of the whole world. Moreover, we will be able to obtain regular guidance, not only on the practice of meditation, but on every other aspect of the spiritual life. Little by little, I managed to calm him down. The interest aroused by spiritualism could, I perceived, be extremely dangerous, and I privately resolved that, whatever Rajgopal and his friends might do, neither Satyapriya nor I should participate in any more experiments with the Ouija board. That we were in contact, through the traveller, with a psychic force independent of our own conscious volitions, I was quite prepared to grant. But there was no evidence whatever, so far as I could see, that the force in question was identifiable with the discarnate personality of Rama, or Mahatma Gandhi, or Swami Vivekananda. There was not even any guarantee that it was of a genuinely spiritual nature, or beneficent, or even that it was more spiritually advanced than we were ourselves. Such being the case, there could be no question of our surrendering ourselves to it absolutely, or of our obeying implicitly any instructions it might give. These arguments, together with my absolute refusal to participate in any further sessions with the Ouija board, soon had the desired effect. Satchapriya's enthusiasm subsided, and he began to feel more than a little ashamed of himself. Fortunately, even before I had succeeded in convincing him of the undesirability of our getting involved in spiritualism, there had occurred the first of a whole chain of events that was to be of far greater value to us, spiritually speaking, than any number of sessions with the Ouija board. Indeed, they were to constitute the most interesting and worthwhile part of our stay in Bangalore, as an important stage of our progress. On our first or second Sunday at Rajgopal's house, in the morning, four or five young men came to see us. In this there was nothing unusual. What was unusual, however, was the way in which they paid their respects to us. Instead of the usual salutation with folded hands, or more or less perfunctory touching of the feet, each of them in turn went through an elaborate full-length prostration that lasted several minutes, and was quite different from anything we had ever seen before. Arms were raised above the head and lowered again, body was spread-eagled on the floor, head turned from side to side, arms extended and withdrawn, one after the other, in wide, sweeping movements. The whole exercise being performed slowly and with great concentration. More remarkable still, all the young men wore Western dress, and all were, inverted commas, educated. That is to say, could read, write, and speak English. When the prostrations had been completed, we entered into conversation with them, making the standard Indian inquiries, and it transpired that they were disciples of an ascetic popularly known as Yalahankar Swami. Yalahankar, they told us, was the name of a small town some 30 miles from Bangalore, where the Swami had his ashram, and where he usually stayed. On hearing that we were staying with Rajgopal, he had told them to go and pay their respects to us. The young men themselves lived in Bangalore, where, it seemed, they all had good jobs. When we asked them the meaning of their unusually elaborate prostrations, They explained that, according to Yalahanka Swami, the majority of people, even religious people, were full of egotism. On account of this egotism, they generally paid their respects to ascetics and holy men in a casual, hasty, and perfunctory manner. Since the purpose of the custom was to help curb egotism, to pay one's respects in this sort of way was of no value whatsoever. Indeed, by making people think how religious they were, or how humble, it could even intensify egotism. The Swami had therefore devised, for the use of his disciples, the long and elaborate type of prostration we had just witnessed, and insisted that, whenever they met a sadhu, they should pay their respects to him by making it a number of times. Sometimes, they added, not without smiling, he even sent them to meet visiting sadhus with the special object of giving them extra practice with their prostration, and, of course, further experience in curbing egotism. Delighted with this explanation, Satyapriya and I plied the young men with further questions. Yalahanka Swami seemed more original in his methods than the ordinary run of Hindu gurus, and we wanted to learn as much about him as possible. For their part, the young men were only too happy to tell us whatever they knew, and in the course of this and subsequent visits, we heard from them a number of anecdotes that threw further light upon the methods and the temperament of their extraordinary master. Among other things, he was a strict disciplinarian, so much so indeed that the disciples felt for him a respect bordering on actual terror. One young man, on going to see him one Sunday morning, had been ordered to take off all his clothes, sit down stark naked, and meditate. This was extraordinary enough, but there was more to come. He had just seated himself in front of the guru, he told us, and was about to close his eyes, when he saw slithering straight towards him, across the floor, an enormous cobra. Terrified, he was about to leap to his feet, when the Swami, with a menacing look, shouted, "Don't move! I'll look after that. You just carry on with your meditation." So great was his fear of the guru, he confessed, far greater than his fear of the cobra, that he had sat there unable to move, while the cobra not only slithered right up to him, but caught itself up in his lap. "Meditate!" the Swami shouted again. As he closed his eyes, he suddenly lost consciousness of his surroundings, his ego dissolved, and he found himself in a state of samadhi or superconsciousness, such as he had never experienced before. When he came to, he and the Swami were still sitting alone together in the room. The cobra had vanished, and the time was some hours later. Subsequently, there had been much discussion among the disciples as to the true nature of the incident. According to some, the cobra was a real one, and had either appeared by accident or been specially summoned by the Swami. According to others, it was not a real cobra at all, and what the young man had in fact seen was a magical illusion conjured up by the Swami in order to test his faith and his powers of concentration. The narrator of the incident professed himself unable to say which of these explanations was correct, and of course, nobody dared ask the Swami. Even more extraordinary was an anecdote related by another disciple, a stout, dark-complexioned elderly woman who spoke nothing but Tamil and was illiterate. According to the Swami, she was the most advanced of his disciples, the young men being less spiritually developed. Apparently, she was particularly experienced in meditation and had great powers of mental absorption. One day the Swami had asked her, "How's the samadhi getting on?" When she replied that it seemed to be getting on fairly well, he said, "All right, let's see." Making her place her hand, palm uppermost, on a wooden board, he had thereupon seized a hammer, and with two or three well-directed blows, had driven a large iron nail right through her hand and into the board. When she neither flinched nor cried out, he exclaimed, "That seems to be all right," and pulled the nail out again. On this occasion, there seemed to be no reason to doubt that the nail was a real nail, not an illusory one, for she still had a small scar on her hand where it had gone through. When Satchapriya and I asked her if she had experienced any pain, she replied laconically, "Not much." What we had heard from the disciples about Yankaswami stimulated rather than satisfied us, and in between their visits we applied for further information to Rajgopal, who had himself met the Swami a number of times. Unlike most ascetics, our friend told us, he was more concerned with the quality rather than the quantity of his disciples, and tended to treat newcomers in so outrageous a fashion as to discourage further visits altogether. High-ranking government officials, who in most ashrams were received with semi-divine honours, fared no better than anybody else. If they showed the slightest trace of arrogance or condescension, he would start abusing them the minute they appeared in the doorway. "What do you want here?" he would shout roughly. "Think you're doing us an honour in coming here, don't you? Think you're a big man? Well, we don't want your bigness here. You can get out, quick." Only if he survived this fusillade was the visitor permitted to enter and asked to sit down. So fierce was the Swami's manner, however, and so violent his abuse, that the majority of visiting dignitaries simply turned and fled. Sometimes, knowing his reputation and anxious to escape rough treatment, visitors would deliberately adopt an attitude of profound humility. But for tactics of this sort, the Swami was more than a match. Springing to his feet, he would welcome such people with every mark of deference, saying how greatly honoured he felt by their visit, and what a blessing it was for his ashram to have such an embodiment of sanctity within its walls. As soon as they were seated in the place of honour, and had been pressed to take tea, or pan, or a cold drink, he would beg them with folded hands to give him and his disciples the benefit of their extraordinary wisdom. On their protesting their unworthiness, as of course they invariably did, he would only redouble his demonstrations of respect, until in the end they collapsed in agonies of embarrassment and begged for mercy. Another of these Swami's practices, Rajgopal said, was to clean people's shoes. For this purpose he always kept by him a good stock of shoe polish of various kinds, as well as brushes and dusters. On days when there were more people at the ashram, and hence a motley collection of footwear lying outside the door, he would sometimes remove to his own room all the shoes, sandals and slippers in sight, and then spend a couple of hours not only scraping them free from dirt, but carefully brushing and polishing them until the worn leather shone like glass. According to orthodox Hindu ideas, it was absolutely unthinkable that a person of higher socio-religious position should touch the shoes of one of lower position, much less still actually clean them. And those unaccustomed to the Swami's ways would react with feelings of mingled horror, astonishment and outrage. The Swami himself would remain unmoved. "You come here to have your soles cleaned, don't you?" he would demand, still polishing. "You don't seem to object to me doing that. If I can clean your soles, why can't I clean your shoes too? Your soles are much more dirty." A similar line of reasoning seemed to underlie another of the Swami's practices. Besides the shoe-cleaning equipment, he also kept in his room a municipal scavenger's uniform. This consisted of a pair of blue cotton shorts, blue shirt, and blue Gandhi cap. Once or twice a week, he would lay aside his saffron robes, don his scavenger's uniform, and seizing the stiff red broom used for such purposes, go and spend the day sweeping out all the latrines in the neighbourhood. Although it was not difficult to detect a method in all this madness, the figure that emerged from the anecdotes of Rajgopal and the disciples, while striking and powerful enough, seemed bizarre and eccentric in the extreme. Yet, bizarre and eccentric as it was, there was something about Yahalankar Swami more extraordinary than anything Satchapriya and I had yet heard. He was at least 600 years old. When Rajgopal at last told us this, he did so with unaccustomed diffidence, as if expecting not merely astonishment, but incredulity and even laughter. He need not have worried. Astonished indeed we were, but while unwilling to accept without question everything we were told, neither my friend nor I was prepared to go to the opposite extreme of rejecting a statement like Rajgopal's out of hand, simply because it was in conflict with currently received notions of what was possible and what impossible. All over the world there were traditions of wise men who had lived for many hundreds of years, and if such longevity had sometimes been achieved in the past, it did not seem unreasonable to suppose that it might occasionally be achieved in the present as well. Had I not already met the Yoga Swami of Jaffna? True, he was only 150 years old. But if a man could live for 150 years, why not for 600? Why not indefinitely? Pleased that his story had not been derided as an old wives' tale, Rajgopal told us more. There was continuous reference to the Swami in local records for the last 600 years, he said, and the fact of his extraordinary longevity was both well known and widely accepted. Knowing how little reliance could be placed even on evidence of this kind, I could not help wondering if all the records of which Rajgopal spoke did, in fact, explicitly refer to one and the same person, or whether there had not been a succession of Yalahankar Swamis, whom folklore and legend had subsequently identified, much as Buddhist tradition had at times confused Nagarjuna the Madhyamika metaphysician with the much later Nagarjuna who was a tantric initiate. Whatever reservations either Satyapriya and I had about the fact of the Swami's longevity, as distinct from the principle of its possibility, what Rajgopal had told us made both of us more eager than ever to see him, and, at our urgent entreaty, he promised to consult with the disciples and see if a meeting could be arranged. As we already knew, the Swami was not an easy person to approach, he warned us, and if we were not to be greeted with a shower of abuse, it would be necessary to proceed with caution. While we were still waiting to hear the outcome of Rajgopal's consultations with the disciples, Satyapriya and I discovered that, for all his devotion, our lively and good-natured host was not above playing a practical joke on us. Knowing our eagerness to meet ascetics and yogis of every kind, he suddenly told us, one Sunday afternoon, that he was taking us to see one of the most celebrated gurus in the whole of South India. "Why didn't I think of it before?" he exclaimed, slapping his forehead with cheerful vexation. Suspecting nothing, we at once asked for further information. Rajgopal was only too happy to oblige. The guru in question, he told us, as we drove through the broad sunlit streets, was the object of special devotion to millions of Tamil-speaking people, and ashrams had been established in his name, not only in the Madras Presidency, where he had been born, but throughout the whole of the adjacent area as well. His principal ashram, however, was in Bangalore, in the heart of the city, and it was there that we were now going. We would not be the only visitors. Every Sunday afternoon, devotees came to pay their respects to the great guru from all over the city, and from even further afield, and the place was usually crowded. With luck, however, we would be able to get a glimpse of him. His name? He would tell us that when we had made his acquaintance, but he was sure we had heard it before. A few minutes later, the car halted in front of a large two-story building that stood several yards back from the road. It did not look very ashram-like, but there were certainly plenty of visitors. Saying we might have to wait, our friend dispatched his son to find out if the guru was at home. While the lad was gone, Satyapriya and I tried to read the blue and white signboard that spanned the entire front of the building. As it was in Tamil, neither of us had much success, and we were still struggling with the angular, unfamiliar letters when Rajgopal's son reappeared. "The guru is at home," he announced with a flourish, "and sends you this prasad with his blessing." On our undoing the leaf-wrapped packets he handed us, our nostrils were pleasantly assailed with a warm, spicy fragrance, as of something hot and savoury. "Guru Masala Dosai," shouted Rajgopal, delighted with the success of his joke. "Three cheers for Guru Masala Dosai, the greatest guru in the whole of South India." Though Satchapriya did not usually appreciate a joke against himself, neither of us could help sharing Rajgopal's merriment and laughing at the way in which we had been taken in. We had certainly heard the name of the guru before. Masala dosa was a favourite Tamil delicacy, and the ashram to which our friend had taken us was famous for the excellence of its dosas all over South India. Even before we had finished our second packet of prasad, Satchapriya and I told Rajgopal that Guru Masala Dosai fully deserved his reputation, and that we were prepared to enroll ourselves as his disciples on the spot. Soon after making the acquaintance of Guru Masala Dosai, we met Yelahanka Swami. The meeting took place not at the Yelahanka ashram, as we had expected, but in an ancient stone-built ashram somewhere in the interior, where the Swami, it seemed, was temporarily staying, and where the disciples and their wives had arranged to spend the weekend with him. Arriving on Saturday evening with Rajgopal and his family, Satchapriya and I found some 2 dozen people quietly chatting in a large room with bare grey walls of undressed stone. Every now and then, someone glanced expectantly, not to say apprehensively, towards a low arched doorway set in the middle of the right-hand wall that seemed to be barred and bolted from within. This was the entrance to the Swami's private quarters, where it was assumed he was still meditating. At any rate, the door had been closed when the earliest arrivals came, in the middle of the afternoon, and nobody had yet seen or heard anything of him. Knowing his ways, however, they showed no astonishment, and, settling down in little groups on the bare stone floor, simply waited for him to emerge in his own good time. As it turned out, they had to wait longer than they expected. 3 hours went by, then 4, then 5, and there was still no sign of the Swami, neither could any sound of him be heard from behind the door. Since he had not given them any previous instructions as to what they should do, nobody dared to start cooking, and nobody dared to go to bed. By 12 o'clock the disciples were feeling not only tired and hungry, but distinctly anxious. Perhaps they had offended the Swami in some way. Perhaps he was angry with them. Perhaps he would not come out of his room at all, and they would have to go away without seeing him. Or perhaps it was a test. At precisely 3 o'clock in the morning, there was a sound of bolts being withdrawn, the small door opened, and the Swami emerged from his confinement. Taken by surprise, despite their long vigil, and not knowing quite what to expect, the disciples struggled to their feet and greeted him as best they could. Having advanced a few steps into the room, the Swami paused, his sturdy saffron-clad figure lit up by the rich yellow glow of the oil lamps. With a shock of surprise, I saw that he had only one eye, and though it was not situated in the middle of his forehead, it gave his features, already grim and terrible enough, so startlingly villainous a cast that they seemed more appropriate to some notorious highwayman or pirate of the old days than to a celebrated ascetic. At the same time, and all this registered instantaneously, Yelahanka Swami had an expression of compassion such as I had seen on no other human face. As for his age, I did not find it difficult to imagine that he was 600 years old or more. He had an immemorial look, like that of some ancient hill, and though he had the outward appearance of a man of 55, it was as though he had been 55 for a very long time. Barely had we finished exchanging greetings when he started issuing his orders. All the women folk were to start cooking immediately. It was time everybody had something to eat, and since we had been fasting since noon the previous day, the meal should be as large and as elaborate as possible. In fact, it should be a regular feast. Despite the lateness, or rather earliness, of the hour, and the relative scantiness of provisions, No one ventured to demur, and the disciples' wives all obediently trooped off to the kitchen, where cauldrons of rice and curry were soon bubbling on the squat, cow-dung-plastered kitchen ranges. In less than 2 hours the feast was ready. Before allowing anyone to sit down to it, however, the Swami announced that the disciples would all have to take a bath, or rather would be given a bath. The women would bathe the men. He himself, assisted by the old Tamil woman, would bathe the two sadhus. Before we well understood what was happening, Satyapriya and I found ourselves in the steaming bathhouse, divested of our robes, with Yalahankar Swami and his chief disciple vigorously soaping us one after the other. Both were extremely gentle in their ministrations, but also extremely thorough. When the job had been completed to their joint satisfaction, we were conducted to the kitchen and seated there in readiness for the meal. From the bathhouse came the sound of loud splashing, mixed with the indistinct murmur of voices. Suddenly we heard the sound of Rajgopal raised in a shout of protest, a protest that was quickly cut short by the gruff tones of the Swami and shrieks of merriment on the part of the women. Afterwards, our friend told us that, coming back into the bathhouse from the kitchen and finding him being soaped down by two of the wives, who were already tittering with suppressed mirth, the Swami had pulled off his jockstrap with the remark that they should do the job properly. According to a widespread Indian belief, shame, in the sense of sexual modesty, was one of the very last fetters to be broken by the disciple in his quest for spiritual enlightenment, with the result that those who practiced religious nudity were traditionally held in high esteem by both Hindus and Jains. Either out of respect for our position as ascetics, or because we had been judged unready for such a renunciation, Satyapriya and I had been suffered to retain our jockstraps, but from Rajgopal, apparently, a higher degree of emancipation was expected. When we asked our friend what his feelings were when he suddenly found himself stark naked in the hands of two giggling women, he replied that, rather to his surprise, he had felt just like a small child. Next morning, or it may have been 2 or 3 days later, we had a second meeting with Yalahankar Swami, this time in his room at the Yalahankar Ashram. Since Satyapriya remained strangely silent throughout practically the whole interview, and since Rajgopal, usually so loquacious, was on this occasion content to function mainly as interpreter, conversation was almost entirely between the Swami and me. As the pair of us talked, and as the single eye was bent sternly but kindly, now on me and now on Rajgopal, I could not help thinking of the great Buddhist teacher Aryadeva, the disciple of Nagarjuna, and the founder, next to him, of the Madhyamaka school. Like Yalahankar Swami, Aryadeva had only one eye and was a native of South India. According to legend, he had also lived for several hundred years. Indeed, according to some accounts, he had mastered the secret of longevity and was still alive somewhere in South India. Was Yalahankar Swami perhaps none other than Aryadeva? Buddhism, having disappeared from the area 5 or 6 centuries ago, and Hinduism having taken its place, for the great teacher to appear in the guise of a Hindu ascetic would be fully in accordance with the compassionate spirit of the Mahayana, which believed in being all things to all men, so that happily some, at least, might be led in the direction of enlightenment. Judging by his extant writings, however, Aryadeva had been in some ways a typical high-caste Indian intellectual, and the Swami did not seem like an intellectual at all. On the contrary, in his outward appearance, as well as in the earnestness and simplicity with which he spoke of his methods, he appeared more like a skilled workman who, knowing his job, could talk about it in a detached, matter-of-fact manner, without intellectual pretensions of any kind. Though the blue cotton uniform, complete with Gandhi cap, hung from a hook by the door, and though shoes and sandals of various sizes, recently polished, stood in shining rows against the wall, it was difficult to imagine that the thick-set figure now so quietly talking to me was the subject of the extraordinary tales we had heard from the disciples. as the conversation ebbed and flowed, with Rajgopal occasionally stopping to ascertain whether he had correctly understood our meaning. The Swami impressed upon me that the only real obstacle to the realization of truth was egotism. Once that had been overcome, he insisted, the religious aspirant would automatically achieve a state of unconditioned spiritual freedom. This was, of course, standard Vedantic, not to say Buddhist, doctrine. I had heard it often before. But Yelahankar Swami spoke with a conviction and authority I had rarely, if ever, encountered. Moreover, unlike many exponents of Vedantic metaphysics, his approach was not theoretical, but practical. Egotism could be overcome only by the prolonged experience of samadhi, by which he meant not meditation in the ordinary sense of the term, but a superconscious state in which all sense of separate individual selfhood was transcended. In the training of his disciples, he said, his sole concern was to eradicate egotism by inducing the samadhi experience. Since there were two different forms of egotism, pride and humility, he had two different methods of dealing with people. With those who were proud, he behaved more proudly still. With those who were humble, with even greater humility. Thus both were made to realize how egotistic they actually were. However high you go, he concluded, addressing me directly, I shall always be above you. However low you go, I shall always be below you. The idea that humility was just as much a form of egotism as pride represented an important new insight for me, and I never forgot the Swami's words. Among the disciples who had accompanied us to the stone-built ashram in the interior, as well as to Yelahankar, was a small, dark, Kannada-speaking Mysorean named Krishna, who invariably wore not only a Western-style jacket and trousers, both rather crumpled, but also an unironed white shirt, collar and tie. Sometimes he also wore a khaki-coloured pith helmet. Though not much more than 30, he was already the owner of one of these small fleets of inadequately serviced motor coaches, which, jolting and rattling along the hundreds of miles of dusty country roads, were the principal means of long-distance transport within the state. Every few weeks he personally inspected one or another of the main routes, some of which took several days to traverse. Not long after our second meeting with Yelahankar Swami, he suggested that we might like to accompany him on his next excursion, which would include Belur and Halivid, with their famous temples, Sringeri, seat of the Shankaracharya of that name, and the Jain hilltop shrine of Shravana Belgola, with its colossal standing figure of Gomateshvara. Krishna's offer had, it seemed, Yelahankar Swami's approval, if it had not been actually inspired by him. And in our eagerness to see more holy places, perhaps meet more holy people, Satyapriya and I accepted with alacrity. Within a few days, we had left Bangalore, the jungles of Mysore had closed behind us, and we were on the first lap of our journey.